I'm good. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Welcome back to the Read Pod, and thanks for joining us for a second time. It was so much fun 2 weeks ago having a chat to you and going through your book, The Octopus of Global Control, and just sort of really providing some information into all of these topics we're getting into on the Read Pod, and really hitting on some stuff that's so interesting to the listeners and myself.
Well, and it's timely too, because now we're at least here in the United States, I'm sure it's worldwide, but we have been having the over the last week, we've been having the farewell tour for George H.W. Bush, and it seems like everywhere you go, the media can't stop tripping over themselves to talk about what a great guy he was, when in actuality, in my book, I sort of jokingly said that if you were locked in a room with a gun, 2 bullets, Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and George H.W. Bush, it would be reasonable to shoot George twice just to make sure. Not that I'm advocating violence, but you know, it was kind of a joke because so many people think that he's such a nice guy, or he was just this old guy in the United States. Back in the knock on him early on was that he was the wimp. I remember he had a big problem.
I've read a lot of that about his persona and how it came across as very soft and sort of, for lack of a better word, wimpy. Everyone was saying
that's right. So you were here. What I'm interested to know, to get your take as someone from Australia coming to the United States and then seeing this parade of just nonstop coverage, what was your take on that?
I mean, I love coming over to the US. I used to spend a lot of time over there with work, and I still have a few business interests in the US, so I love the country, and I love being over there, and especially in a time like this when something so big is happening. But you were right. The news, between the news and the mainstream news media and what other people were reporting sort of online and things like that, there was a complete opposite, polar opposite between what was being said. I mean, it was this huge, you know, like he was God's gift to humanity almost, which, I mean, even someone that's not an expert on George Bush Sr., and it's even someone that only knows a little bit about, you know, his lies with the war and with the Kuwait war and with the kids and the hospital and basically creating means for people to start sending people to war, like what his son did. I knew that he wasn't a good person. And it's just another example of where we're at with this issue with media.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think it's assumed if you get to become the president, you're probably not a good person on many levels. I think the last universally loved president in the United States was Kennedy, and everybody after that was pretty much a reprehensible human being, in part because that's kind of the personality trait you need in order to get to that level. And also, you have to be a bit of a psychopath to want to be the president. So when George H.W. Bush, his reputation prior to becoming president, like real close to, early 88 or 1987 and 86, his reputation was that he was the wimp. That was the nickname that they had for him. It was meant to be a very dismissive name, but I think he liked it. I think he liked it because it provided him the cover to operate like a psychopath, but still have everybody believe that he was just the sweet old guy that was a little bit wimpy. And then I remember they played up the fact that he said, you know, I'm a grown man and I don't like broccoli and I don't have to eat my broccoli. If I don't want to eat it, I won't eat it. And everyone was like, you go, George, you stand up against broccoli. You know, and it was just like, I didn't realize it at the time, how preposterous it was, because I was just a little bit too young. But it's once again, it's like you said, it's the media painting this picture of a person and creating this image of a person that is in direct contrast to who the person truly is. So, I mean, if we want to get into George H.W. Bush, I mean, most of the people in the United States these days, when they think of Bush, they think of George W. Bush. And I would say that George W. Bush probably gets the bronze medal for the worst person in the Bush family, because his dad was awful and his grandfather was terrible as well.
See, now this is really where it gets crazy. And when you said before, you mentioned that to be a US president, you've got to be some sort of psychopath or whatever else. Some people would listen to that and go, oh, come on, like, that's a bit harsh, or that's too much. Now, the Bush family is a prime example of what you're saying, as far as justifying what you're saying.
Oh, yeah.
Because this is their lineage and the history in such a short history is so scary to think that it went fairly untouched and unpromoted to the world at large when they... To think that a family with such a sort of reprehensible involvement and relationship to the Nazis has not one but two presidents within their short history is fucking baffling, to be honest,
it's
isn't it?
Crazy. Like, yeah. So the if we back up to the beginning of World War II, you've got Prescott Bush, who is George H.W. Bush's dad, George W. Bush's grandpa. He is the president of Union Bank, and Union Bank is a Rockefeller-controlled bank. Part of what he did was he loaned money to, you know, as most big banks do. They loan money. They love wars because they can loan it to both sides. But he was instrumental in partnering with Thiessen, who was a big German industrialist, kind of like a Rockefeller
steel,
of Germany.
Was that a steel company? Or
yeah, owned a steel company. Yeah, exactly. Or maybe he's probably more in line with Carnegie since he's in the steel industry, but whatever. He was an industrialist in Germany, and they partnered up together and they loaned money to the Nazis. They financially fueled Hitler. It's not a debatable topic. That was a fact. He did that. He was busted for it. They stripped him of all of his assets. They could have hung him for the Trading with the Enemies Act, but he had such a tight relationship back home to the USO, which is like a troop how would I describe it? USO is kind of like a union for the military. So it's like where all the troops get together, and you can have, there's like a USO lounge in a lot of the airports. If you fly into LAX, there's a USO lounge over there by the big encounter spaceship looking thing. And if you're a military, you can go hang out in there or whatever. So Prescott Bush was the head of that. And so they thought, from a PR standpoint, it would look bad to hang the head of the USO for trading with the enemies. So instead they just said, go away. Don't do this anymore, and we're going to put you somewhere else. So he sort of disappeared after World War II for a while. Now, what's crazy about this, among other things, is that he's financing Hitler, right? His operation, his bank is financing the enemy, so to speak, for America. And meanwhile, H.W. Bush, his son, is a Navy pilot, and he's flying missions against the enemy, the same enemy that his dad is financing. So, I mean, you want to talk about when I say that you have to be psychopathic, what father would finance the opposite side of a war that his son was fighting in? Well, psychopathic fathers probably would. And this is going back to the whole, this is, you'll start to see this theme play out, which is, you know, they're all in the same family, but their loyalty seems to be towards, towards something bigger than their family, and not maybe in a good way. So Prescott Bush is a big time banker. After the war, he still continues in the banking industry and becomes a senator, I believe, in Connecticut. And that they grew up mostly. George H.W. Bush grew up in Connecticut, went to Yale. Prescott Bush went to Yale. W went to Yale, all skull and bones, the whole thing. Then they later moved to Texas. And so they're sort of known as being this Texas family. But the reality is they started off in the Northeast part of the country. So George H.W. Bush winds up going to work for the CIA after the military. By the way, a military career in which he was a pilot, and he ejected out of his, or he jumped, you know, he parachuted out of his plane that had been shot. But according to the other planes that were in the area, it wasn't shot so bad that he had to jump, that he had to bail out, parachute out. And some of the guys in his plane didn't have parachutes, and so they all died. So I think he was the only one that lived from that. So there were a lot of questions that talked about him being a war hero. And here we go with the media coming in and saying, yeah, oh, he's this great war hero. Well, the guys that were in the planes next by have a story that's quite different from what HW tells.
But anyway. So how are they? Okay, so let's just look at a basic fundamental here. How are they framing it as he's a war hero when he has connections to the Nazis, when his family has like direct connections to the Nazis? Like, how are they even?
How well, they don't mention the Nazi. They don't mention the Nazi part, for one.
No, how is it not believed in mainstream media that a connection to the Nazis is real? Because why isn't that getting clearly connect, like, do you know what I'm saying? Like,
it, yeah, just... I do know what you're saying. I don't think it's not that people don't believe it, it's that people don't know anything about it. They just don't, they never mentioned it. So it's not denied. I mean, it's an undeniable fact that Prescott Bush was involved in that. He was, like I said, he was damn near hung for it. They just tell the story. I mean, they paint this narrative that he was in war, and he was. He was a bomber pilot. H.W. Bush, I'm talking about, was a bomber pilot, and flew, you know, lots of missions. And they can, you know, and they can say, you know, you lived, and you came, you know, you lived through it, and so that makes you a war hero. I don't know. It makes you a war participant, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know about the hero part, but when the media is creating this narrative of you, and you're going to become president, and you're going to wind up in this, you're going to wind up in the CIA and head the CIA, then it just becomes hero. They just add the hero part to it, and then you're a war hero, and then everyone repeats it over and over again, and then nobody examines it anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah. So he winds up, so H.W. Bush winds up after the service going into the Central Intelligence Agency, which for us is an external intelligence agency. So CIA's mandate is to conduct intelligence operations outside of the US, not inside. The inside is the FBI. So in Britain, it would be MI5 is like FBI, MI6 is the CIA. So that's sort of the way it's set up. So he goes into the CIA, which is intelligence external to the United States. But he's one of the few people that can't remember where he was the day that John F. Kennedy was shot. Which is you know, interesting, because this is like, you know, this is like one of the, it was before I was born, but still, people that were born and old enough to be aware of it, they know where they were. And he's exactly. Like, well, you know, I just don't know where I was. Well, there's pictures of him, maybe, you know, not 100% conclusive, but there's a picture of him standing in front of a building in Dallas, Texas that day. So he's in the area, right? So this is the first aspect of George H.W. Bush being a coincidental component of his life that pops up. And that is, can't remember where he was when Kennedy was killed, yet there's a picture of him in front of a building in Dallas. So that puts him in the area. And the fact that he's unwilling to talk about where he was is, of course, sketchy, but it doesn't necessarily prove anything. I don't think anybody is saying that George H.W. Bush pulled the trigger, but they are saying that he was involved in some way, simply because his story doesn't add up, and there's and the type of person he was, he would want to be involved in this. And then as you see later on, as he rises to power, along with the other co-conspirators of the Kennedy assassination, you start to see them rise, like Lyndon Johnson and people like this. You know, you see these guys in positions of power in, after that, and you wonder why. And it's probably because they played ball. But, you know, once
they
again, nobody can.
Yeah.
Right. So he becomes the head of, years later, he becomes the head of the CIA. And that is, of course, an extremely powerful position. And you don't, much like becoming president, you don't become the head of the CIA without having some decent connections in the underworld, some amazing political connections, and the dirt, and somebody has dirt on you, of course, because they need to be able to control you, much like the CIA controls other people. Don't think for a second that the head of the CIA isn't getting controlled as well. This is the J. Edgar Hoover who started it, and or who came into power after the Dulles brothers formed it. And he was, you know, the cross-dressing head of the CIA who was out to get everybody else for being homosexual, when in fact he was one himself. But that's beside the point.
Which is usually the case.
Which is usually the case. So as the head of the CIA, George Bush is involved during the Iran-Contra affair in the United States. And basically what that was that the United States wanted to arm the Contras, but they couldn't do it through Congress. So they had to find a different way to fund this war. So what they did was they imported cocaine from the Colombians, used that money to buy weapons, and sent the weapons to the Contras. And that was a huge scandal. But it was the first time that people started to understand that the CIA was involved in drug running. And it became, of course, ironic, or, you know, hypocritical, that when Bush, H.W. Bush, became president, his big thing was the war on drugs and the say no to drugs and all that stuff, which makes you want to scream, because he was in charge of the agency that was importing all of the cocaine into the United States. And so, you know, this will become a theme, not just with the Bushes, but with all presidents. It's the one thing that they're screaming the loudest against is usually the one thing that they themselves are involved in. So H.W. Bush is running the CIA. They're heavily involved in the drug trafficking. Then he wants to run for president in 1980, but there was a political calculation that said he wouldn't win, but Reagan probably would win. And Reagan was going to have, I think, Jack Kemp as his vice president, but couldn't have him because he was such a compromised pedophile that there was no way that they were going to allow that to happen. So they basically told Reagan he was going to take on George H.W. Bush as his vice president. They did not like each other. They were not friends. They were not on the same. It was a political calculation on Reagan's part too. It was, okay, well, I want to be president, so I got to drag this guy with me, but I don't like him and I certainly don't trust him. A couple months after becoming president, Reagan is shot. And he doesn't die. He misses death by millimeters, the doctor said, missed an artery. But he was shot by John Hinckley Jr. Now,
the Hinckley family knew the Bushes, didn't they, somehow?
The Hinckley family and the Bush family were friends. Yeah. They had one of the Bush sons, I think it was Neil, was supposed to have dinner with the Hinckleys the night before the shooting, and it didn't wind up happening. So here's the second coincidence where Ronald Reagan is shot by a Hinckley. The Hinckleys and the Bushes are very good friends, and to the point where their families are having dinners with one another. And just out of sheer luck, Reagan survives and Bush is not president, because of course, if he had died, then Bush would have been president.
Yeah.
He winds up staying with Reagan for the full 8 years as vice president, and then in 1988 he runs and wins the presidency.
So with a president getting shot like that, obviously the police don't investigate it. Would it be the FBI that investigated?
Given it's
the inside. Yeah,
and it was just such an obvious patsy move. I mean, it was one of those things where the guy didn't make an attempt to hide anything. You know, they played the crazy card and said, well, this guy likes to read Catcher in the Rye 7 times a day and he's a maniac. And all those things. And that's really interesting, and it makes for a good conversation, I guess. But the reality is that, you know, this has all of the markings of a Manchurian candidate, a programmed killer. Now, that might sound like something straight out of Hollywood, probably because Hollywood has taken these concepts and has made them into movies. But when George Bush was running the CIA, the CIA was working on MKUltra mind control. And of course, that's what you would use to have a Manchurian candidate to, you know, to say a code word and, you know, whisper a code word or read a certain passage in The Catcher in the Rye and trigger you into a, you know, into a shooting rampage, which is, of course, what happened. Then you get to 1988. George H.W. Bush becomes president. In 89, the front page of the Washington Post is a huge headline that says President and Vice President ensnarled in VIP prostitution ring at the White House. That's on the front page of the Washington Post. And that is having to do with what is known as the Franklin scandal or the Franklin cover-up. There was a book written about it. That was an organization running out of Nebraska, which is right in the center of the United States, by a guy named Lawrence King. He was a large black dude who owned a bank, and he was trafficking. He would sing the national anthem at like the Republican National Convention. He was a big player, and he was trafficking boys from Boys Town, which is like an orphanage in Nebraska. Yeah. And he was putting them on his private jet, flying them to Washington, D.C., and they were getting private tours of the White House at midnight through a guy named Craig Spence. Craig Spence was the 1980s version of Jeffrey Epstein. He was running a blackmail operation using these underage boys to ensnare pedophile politicians and get them under control. Now, George H.W. Bush was...
Sorry to interrupt you, but like... Yeah. As we mentioned when you first came on, it's all about getting this dirt on these people so you can control them, essentially.
Yeah.
So finding out what their vices are, whether it's drugs, whether it's horribly crazy shit like pedophilia.
Right.
It's getting them in these vulnerable positions and catching them, and then you've got them forever, basically.
For sure, yeah. Used to be you catch a politician cheating on their wife and use that as blackmail. Then it might be a closeted homosexual, somebody that doesn't want that information out there. I've got a wife and kids. Don't tell anyone. I'll do whatever you want. And then, yeah. But the mother load is to, if you can catch them, you know, as a pedophile. And sometimes they allow the pedophiles to rise up to these positions of power. A more recent example of that is Denny Hastert, who was the Speaker of the House just a couple years ago. He was a notorious pedophile. He had been raping boys back when he was a high school wrestling coach, and that he had been extorted for four decades for millions and millions of dollars. But he was third in line to become the president of the United States. And he was a full-blown, out-of-control pedophile. Good friends with John Podesta, by the way. I think it's worth noting. And you know, he was later locked up. I mean, he's in prison now for that. So that works to control somebody forever. I mean, there's no, you don't just say, well, I divorced my wife, or hey, I came out of the closet and it's no secret anymore, and I don't care who knows. It's, you don't come out of the pedophile closet. You're just
you don't. There's no closet.
There's no closet big enough.
Big enough for that.
So this is what's going on. So in 89, this comes out in the Washington Post, this headline, and it is
okay.
Bold.
So Bush is
the president now.
President.
He's the president
in
now,
88. So 89, this comes out in the Washington Post.
And it's looking back on when he was vice president and when Reagan was president. Yeah. So it's looking back. A couple years earlier than that. So he becomes the president. Of course, that investigation goes nowhere because he's the president now. And we start to creep towards the first Gulf War. And that was an incident where, I mean, allegedly, Iraq invaded Kuwait to steal their oil. And then the United States intervened on behalf of Kuwait to push Iraq out of there. And then they sort of decimated them, but they didn't do a full job of destroying and taking Saddam Hussein out of power. Saddam Hussein had been working with the CIA for decades. I mean, they wanted him in power. They kind of like maniacs like that, strong arm guys. They can keep their people in line. So although he was portrayed to be a horrible guy, and of course I think he was a horrible guy. As far as the CIA and the United States government was concerned, he was a horrible guy, but he served the purpose and he was kind of the right guy for that job, to meaning the right dictator for Iraq. He also did what we needed him to do with, you know, and after the Gulf War, he sort of backed off and I think he got the message for a while. But the lead up to the Gulf War is something I remember pretty well, because I was a freshman in college in the fall of 1990, and this war started in January of 91. And I remember being glued to my TV because it was Bernard Shaw from CNN under the bed in this hotel in Iraq, you know, bombs going off and night vision tracers following the anti-aircraft guns. It was crazy. It was like the closest, you know, most of us had been to a war. Plus, definitely, it was kind of mixed in a little bit with a video game aspect. So it was like compelling television for sure. And of course, my favorite target is CNN. And you've got Charles Jacko from CNN in some studio somewhere with a green screen and fake palm trees and sirens going off and running around in circles like a moron. So, but the lead up to this.
Sorry to interrupt you there. Like, when did it become legal to do that? Like, how is it legal to do that? We just did a podcast. One of our biggest shocks as Australians, I mean, there's a few shocks of when you go to the US, is the medical advertising on TV, where they're scared, everything, you've got, you know, a sore leg and you're dead. You know, you're losing your hair. Oh shit, you're dying. Take this. Like, it's enough to put anyone on so much edge. It's scary, but like with the staging of the news and things like that, like, is that even legal?
And it is now. Yeah, it was legalized in 2012. Well, it technically went into law in 2013. The Smith Modernization Act. So what it was that there 70 years ago or so, there was something called the Smith-Mundt Act, and that basically made it illegal for the media to use propaganda against the American people. A reasonable law. Okay, I don't know
Obama passed it, yeah.
And Obama passed the Modernization Act, which said, well, yeah, you can. Basically, it wasn't that the Smith-Mundt Act was expiring or anything like that. It would have been just fine to continue on for the next couple decades. But he went in and changed it. The Modernization Act of 2012 said that it is legal to use propaganda. You just can only do a couple hundred hours a week. So it became legal to lie on TV. And from that point forward, you start to see a rash of false flag shootings all throughout the United States, which I've documented in my book are 100% totally bullshit staged events that are either drills that have gone live or they've always been meant to be drills. So but the media's role in all these false flags gets us back to where the media news really got their start. And that was CNN becoming the go-to place for the Gulf War. Now, the lead up to the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, the one in 91, the January, the lead up to that, what a lot of people don't remember, there was no support for it. America was like, fuck the Kuwaitis, man. You are on your own. Like, this is not our war. You've got Saudi Arabia right next to you. Why don't you ask them to help you out? They're your buddies. You know, like, we don't need to be involved in this. And there was no support for it. So it was not going to happen.
Looking for a motive.
Right.
Not a motive. They were looking for a reason.
A justification for it. Yeah. And so they go to the old trick of getting, you know, sympathetic American people. Americans are very nice. They're very they want to help. We go about it in the wrong way a lot of times, but we're very generous and we're very up for getting involved and helping out where we can if we think there's some injustice being perpetrated. The irony is that we're usually the ones creating the injustice unbeknownst to the vast majority of the American public has no fucking idea what's going on. They think that the things that they see on the news are true, and they think, oh my God, these Russians are coming to get us. It's all, you know, so we've been dumbed down.
It's getting preyed upon. you know, do you know what I mean? Like that support and wanting to help the thy neighbor and all that sort of stuff, it just gets preyed upon. So
and that was what they did in 1990. So the end of 90, they have this hearing, a Senate hearing, where they're bringing in witnesses to some of the atrocities in Kuwait, and they have the girl who's Naraya, and she's the 15-year-old girl who goes up there and in front of this group testifies that she worked at a hospital and that the Iraqi soldiers came in and took the babies out of the incubator and left them to die on the cold floor. Okay, that was a lie.
And she was the daughter of the Iranian U.S.
ambassador.
Iranian ambassador to the, right. to the U.S.
She
had no, she'd been prepped for that.
She was prepped for that by a PR company called Hill & Knowlton. This is not opinion. This is not, you know, conjecture. It's been admitted to now. It's a fact. They have admitted that. And it didn't actually take too long. It was just a couple years afterwards.
And when you look at people, like, you could say, oh, that's such a small thing. But that sort of emotive moment can turn a nation. It's like when you see footages of injustice, like of a child being hurt or at war or being dragged along a thing or something like that. Moments like that can change a whole country's opinion overnight.
And it did. That was the that was what did it. And it wasn't just this girl. There were other people that came out and said, I buried the bodies of 14 of these children. I swear to, you know, this guy goes on and on and on. Totally full of shit himself. George H.W. Bush repeated it multiple times. And they were leaving children. They were killing children. He's going on and on and on about this. It's all lie. It was the justification. The polls before that, nobody wanted this war. The polls after that, let's get them. Let's get those motherfuckers. I mean, that was the mentality. It changed overnight. And it was because of that. So here we are getting lied into a war. From an American standpoint, in terms of number of Americans lost, relatively small. It was a slaughter. But Iraqis that were killed, and Kuwaitis too, if you were killed by the United States, you were killed based on a lie, because that was the justification for it, was they're killing children. We got to get in there and do something about it. I don't know why the United States decided to be the policeman of the entire world, but they've taken that role on themselves. And I mean, I think we do know why, but yeah. It's frustrating to us. We're like, clean up your own mess. And then, you know, these other countries will go, yeah, but our mess is because of you guys. And you're like, oh yeah. Okay. I guess you're right. So George H.W. Bush lies us into this war, you know, through the media, concocts this lie, and we get into the war. And that becomes a theme with his son as well, who learns how to take a lie and turn it into, take some a story that's not true, repeat it in the media, use the mainstream media to just club everyone into submission, and then after that, demonize anybody that dares to criticize their us being involved in this war. For they paint them as being unpatriotic. So it's an easy strategy. It's not the United States that came up with it. Hitler did a really good job of putting that into play. So you get George H.W. Bush, who then presides over this war and then gets criticized for it, rightly so, because he mismanaged it. He didn't do a very good job. He said he were going to go in and get Saddam Hussein and everything, and he didn't do it. And, you know, like I look at that and go, and I think, good. I'm glad. I'm not into war. I'm not into us just then invading Baghdad like we did, you know, a decade later. But he doesn't finish the job, and pays the price for that when it comes to election time. And then Bill Clinton comes in, you know, and when Clinton ran against him, they played this as two teams that hated each other. But in actuality, they weren't.
Yes. So this is what's totally been baffling to me recently. And maybe I'm naive, but I miss the whole Clinton-Bush friendship and relationship.
Don't feel bad.
I ate up the whole narrative that they hated each other, that they're from two different like sides of the fence, and it couldn't be further from the truth.
They were business partners together. So as when the CIA was running cocaine into the United States, they were running it into a very small airport in Arkansas, in a city called Mena, Arkansas. They just made a movie about it called American Made a couple years ago with Tom Cruise playing Barry Seal as a CIA pilot flying cocaine in. They don't even hide it. It's not even, they're not even ashamed of it or trying to deny it any longer. But what they don't talk about in that movie is that who was the governor of Arkansas at the time? It was Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton was partnered up with George. They could have picked any state to fly this, almost any state, to fly this cocaine into. Arkansas is not on the coast, so it is not a natural, it's not a natural airport to stop. It's not the first place you would stop, like Miami or maybe Houston, someplace that's the southernmost part.
Where's Arkansas? Is it like, so is it central?
It's north of, if you look where New Orleans is, so in between Texas and Florida, you have New Orleans. It's just one state up from New Orleans, just one state north. So not too far, but still not a natural location for, a drop spot for cocaine. But they had protection and they had it figured out and they had it, arranged in a way that the planes could get there. And that was Bill Clinton's operation. He did a good job there. He did a really good job for the CIA and he played ball and he was rewarded with that and he became the president. I'm sure George H.W. Bush would have liked to have stayed for another term, but if he was going to lose out, he might as well lose out to his business partner, because now he's behind the scenes. Now he can pull the strings without anybody watching him, which is what he liked to do, which is what he was great at doing. So with Bill Clinton now in the White House, the cocaine was still flowing in. That is a funding mechanism for empires that has been going on for hundreds of years. This is nothing new for the United States. They've just taken this business model and perfected it. And we saw it in Vietnam when they were running opium from Southeast Asia into the United States through the CIA. We see it again in Afghanistan when they're guarding the poppy fields and the CIA is running the heroin out of Afghanistan and into the United States. So this is a coordinated effort, and this is something that has been going on for a very, very long time. And it's not something that most people hear about on their nightly news, but once they dig into it, they understand that this is an undeniable fact. So H.W. Bush is now out of the limelight, but very much still in control. He becomes a part of a bank called BCCI, nicknamed Banks for Criminals and Crooks International. It is the funding arm. When the CIA cocaine is coming in, BCCI is handling that. It's operational for, I want to say, like 9 years, 10 years or so. It eventually gets shut down because it is such an overwhelming money laundering operation that it is hard to miss it. And of course, H.W. Bush distances himself from that, but he was involved in the creation of it. Remember, his dad was a banker with Union Bank. So he understands banking and he knows that through your army of lawyers and banks, you can move tons of money around discreetly, especially when you have the cover of the CIA and the presidency. So this was part of that. As then the Clintons go through, Bill Clinton goes through 8 years in office, and we get to George W. Bush, and we have 9/11, and then as we all know what happened there. But once again, he used the same tactics of weapons of mass destruction. That was, they're gassing their own people. We have to get in there and intervene. And then they tried that flimsy attempt to connect Saddam Hussein to 9/11 somehow, which was laughable, and yet it still worked. And you have people going in front of Senate hearings, and you have Colin Powell holding up the little vial and say, weapons of mass destruction. He's building chemical weapons. And then you have Robert Mueller, who's leading the Trump investigation. Let's not forget about Robert Mueller, who sat there and said, we have to go into Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction. So before anyone starts thinking that Robert Mueller is this hero who's coming in to save the day, understand that he is part of this group. He is knee deep in it, and he was there selling that lie along with Cheney and all these other people. So,
and with the you mentioned how his son started doing the exact same thing as far as selling this fear of either weapons of mass destruction or trying to help out other countries. Have you heard the rumor of how was it George Bush, George H.W. Bush was at breakfast or lunch with one of the bin Ladens at the time of 9/11?
Yeah. So after BCCI went under, he became part, and after he left presidency, he became a partner in the Carlyle Group. And the Carlyle Group is I don't know how to describe them, investment firm started by Carlucci, who was put together this group of very powerful ex-intelligence officers, ex-politicians, and wealthy businessmen, and they would solicit money from investors and use that money to through their political connections to turn that into even more money. So
like an investment firm, but through
an investment firm that was loaded with high power, prominent Washington, Wall Street, and banking firms. It was a well-connected group. You would become a board member there if you had been like a four-star general who retired, or, you know, you had a aerospace, the military industrial complex. Generals would sit on the board there, and then they would make broker arms deals and things like that. So they were they're a publicly traded company. You can see them on the New York Stock Exchange. So they're not hiding anything, but George H.W. Bush is a partner in the Carlyle Group. And on the morning of September 11th in Washington, D.C., he was having a meeting with the bin Laden family on behalf of the Carlyle Group. So here we go. This is now the third time we've had a major event in American history in which the Bush family has coincidentally been involved. First, we've got the Kennedys. Then we've got Reagan getting shot and the Hinckley family being close friends. Now we have 9/11 and the bin Laden family being business
and
partners of the Bushes.
And the Nazis as well.
Yeah, right. I almost forgot about the Nazi connection. There's so many more recent. It's crazy. So you know, a lot of people remember that all the planes were grounded on 9/11 the next couple days, except one that was allowed. Well, I think two. There was one that went to Israel, and there was another one that had the bin Laden family on it. They were allowed to leave, which is fascinating. But, you know, so what are the chances that George H.W. Bush just happens to be having a business meeting with the family of the alleged terrorist mastermind that did this to the United States? Well, of course, I think most people watching this understand that 9/11 was not conducted by Osama bin Laden and 19 Arab hijackers. It was a much more devious operation than that. And, you know, but the Bushes are in the money making business. They always have been. They don't care whether it's, you know, whether it's doing business with the Nazis or running cocaine or money laundering it or the oil business or doing deals with the bin Laden family. They're in the middle of it. They're knee deep into it. So, I mean, the Clintons are sort of taking the baton from the Bushes and running, but the Bush family showed how you do it, how you quietly amass a goddamn fortune, all under shady, real shady circumstances.
They're all compromised as well. Yeah, as far as obviously with HW, he was compromised with the stuff that was happening in 1990 that you mentioned with the Washington Post and things like that.
George H.W. Bush is a notorious pedophile, horrible pedophile.
So you say that, and
yeah,
this is something that I'm a parent. Are you a parent?
I am a parent. Yeah.
Yeah. So to be honest, it's something that I only, I must have been naive growing up, but an open secret was the first thing that moved that doco that recently that's got me on a massive wormhole with this topic.
For sure. Yeah.
And has, to short of being able to sort of say anything else, it's fucked me up.
It is a crazy, I'm in the same boat as you. I was late to this party to understanding how that all works. And it is the worst thing you can do. As far as I'm concerned, it's the worst thing you can definitely do. And yet these people
it's hurting you helpless. And it's sort of like animals as well. I'm not comparing animals to children, but like someone that hurts a defenseless animal or something, or, you know, maims it for no reason. It's the same, like kids are helpless.
Yeah. And what happens to the people that are hurting harmless animals when they're kids? They become serial killers. You know, I mean, exactly. A lot of them do. And so if you're somebody that's harming kids, what do you become? You become a monster. You know,
you mentioned something that spurned off, which I like to go deep into things. If I hear something, I'll write it down and I'll look into things further. And when we were talking last time, you mentioned something about Nicole Kidman's father, Anthony Kidman. And I was like, I live in Australia. Surely I should know the full details of this. And I hadn't heard anything. And I really didn't know. I heard whispers, but I didn't know anything. So I started looking into the story, and I got onto this website called independentaustralia.net. And there's a lady called Fiona Barnett on that website. Yes. Have you heard about her testimony?
I have. Yes.
And that's literally 20 kilometers. She lives 20 kilometers from my house. Wow. Okay, so not far. Well, from what I gather.
Right.
We have not heard anything of that. Nothing gets said of her story. And she is, like, the police stations that she's referencing are all in my neighborhood. You know, this is how widespread that issue is.
Yeah.
And she's talking about, and they've got a pedophile ring, and basically there's a flag. Mm-hmm. That they all put up. I mean, I never
heard about any of that stuff either. And then all of a sudden you start to dig into it a little bit. And then you realize that there's this pedophile code, there's code words and symbols and all of these things. And you go, geez, you know, this is unsettling. And the FBI has a list of all the pedophile code symbolism. And then you start to see those symbols showing up in other things, showing up as logos for other companies. And you're like, God damn, is this a coincidence, or are they involved in that? Do they know it? I mean, if you want to think of a good way to keep people silent is if you had everybody at a big party, like a skull and bones type party, and everybody had to do something horrible to a child in front of everybody else, then everybody's complicit and nobody's talking and everybody is bonded together forever on that. And that is how, that's like, you know, just sort of the glue that holds these secret societies together. It's the glue that holds gangs together too. You want to join the Crips? Well, let's go, you know, you gotta go rape a white woman. If you want to get into where I went to USC, there was a gang called the Harpies that were down the street from USC. And the word was, if you wanted to get in that gang, you had to rape a USC girl. Okay, well, that's a good way to get you into the gang, because now everybody knows that you're guilty of that. You can't rat on them because they know what you've done. You can't, you know, so it ties everybody together. You commit a crime as part of a group, or let the group, you know, witness it or know about it, then everybody is in the same spot where they can't rat on each other. So the pedophile rings are the dirtiest, of course, because it's an unspeakable act. And it is, I'm just blown away with how rampant apparently it is. And it's terrifying.
Okay. So it is terrifying. And let's look at the Anthony Kidman thing just for instance and things like that. So say that there's a higher power that's pulling all the strings, you know, everyone's got right. their own theories, and say there's a right. higher power. Clearly that higher power can't be pro-pedophilia. They must just be using all these people. But do you know what I mean? They must just realize that this is a great tool, that there's some sick people. Because if you look at the Independent Australia article, which you've probably read about, I think, Fiona Barnett, there's politicians, like high-ranking Australian politicians, that are accused in this as well.
Oh, yeah. There
I,
is.
I just don't get the end. I don't get the end. I'm struggling to understand the end play. I just, especially with the pedophilia stuff, I just don't know how these people are getting through society and continue to just live their lives and be successful. And the strange thing with Nicole Kidman is her career, when all that sort of came out, her career sort of fell off a cliff.
Anybody can be just about anybody can become an actor or actress, you know. The casting process is a very random one. Some people get picked and they become famous actors and actresses. They have talent, but that, you know, then they build on that. But it is, I lived in LA for 20 years and I saw that. I wasn't an actor, but I saw friends of mine, you know, you go on audition after audition, and what separates you from somebody else is nobody really knows. Nobody's quite sure, but some people rise up in power. Some people rise up in Hollywood the same way people rise up in Washington, D.C. And it, part of it becomes, you know, they let you into the club. And unfortunately, the club is a dirty club filled with sick people. But once again, everybody has control. It's a control mechanism to keep everybody in check. We see that in the music industry, too, which is just rampant with sexual abuse, pedophilia, things like that. You think and starlets that break down, that have nervous breakdowns years after becoming a star, and you wonder, why is it? Why is Britney Spears shaving her head? Why is Katy Perry falling off the stage? Why are all these people? Why is Rihanna? Why does she have satanic symbols in all of her videos? Why are they doing these crazy Luciferian rituals at the Super Bowl for the halftime show? Is this connected? Is this random? And what you start to see as you pull back and get a view of the bigger picture is that it's not accidental. It's not a random event. It's intentional, and it is using this medium of television and to put their worldviews out there, hidden encoded messages. It's crazy. And the first time you hear it, you go, That's too much. Like, I'm not willing to go down that path. But the more you dig into it, the more you look at these things, you start to see that there is a link, and it is this Luciferian cult, like at the core. And I'm not a religious person, so I know some people that are like really Christian. Their go-to insult is to call somebody, the devil or Satan. That guy's satanic. I mean, that's not my go-to insult. So when I say someone, you know, that there's a big Luciferian connection, I don't mean that in like a sort of general term, meaning like trying to lump everyone in and call them an asshole. I'm saying that it is their religion of Luciferianism. And it is I'm not in it, so I don't know the ins and outs of it. But I'm from the outside looking in. It's a cult of people that have a very different way of seeing the world, and they stick together. And that's why you see a lot of the common thread throughout Luciferianism is pedophilia. And that's something that has been talked about for a while. It's just starting to kind of come out to the masses, how that works. And it and the pedophilia in Hollywood works the same way that it works in Washington, D.C. You know, once you're in, you're in, and you can't leave, and you can't talk about it, or else they expose you, or they ruin your career, or they kill you. You know, so there's a price for leaving.
I've heard a lot about the Grammys and the background, just I'm not all over this Luciferians and all this sort of stuff in the music industry. Like, I've heard Illuminati talks and I know rough things and whatever else. But on a personal note, I know of people, stories about the Grammys and stories about the awards shows and things like that. Is the Grammys the music one?
Yeah.
And people that get nominated for that and the process behind that and what they do, especially with some Australian artists, and that is extremely shady. Yeah. I just know from even firsthand accounts with that. And you just have to look at some of the people that are getting put up. It doesn't make any sense because there is so many talented. I've got lots of friends in the music industry and so many talented friends that are just making incredible stuff, and they simply can't get through that door. Like because they're not playing, I guess they're not playing ball, and there's nothing in it for the, you know, the powers that be to get off them. I mean, there's some great artists that do it the right way and they're doing really well and they get through and it's their passion. But there's definitely something sinister involved there, which is scary.
Talent is optional these days in the music industry. They will take auto-tune you. It's not. It used to be that you had to be a musician and you had to play your instrument and you had to put out albums and you had to go play live and everything. Now it's auto-tuned it's just an image. It's not even a real. First of all, it's not their song. They didn't write it. It's written by the same group of guys. That's like, there's like seven of them and you'll see their names on like all of these hit songs. It's like, they're just like a factory of making music. And they take young girls. They say, you're going to be a pop star. You're going to be, Katy Perry is doing gospel music and is going nowhere. Next thing you know, they bring her in, they glam her all up, and she is the next big thing. And she's out of her fucking mind half the time, you know. She was rewarded for this. She makes, you know, a ton of money. And then what are you going to do? You're going to leave? You're going to walk away from all that? Even if you could, would you want to? You know. There's something dark to this, to the music industry and to the movies. There's a darkness there.
I'd love to understand the darkness of what's happening with Kanye West and the Kardashians and that whole loop and the release of music. Like, he recently released a song through Pornhub. And I just think, you've got two kids, you've got however many kids, you've got endless places to release your music and you're releasing it through Pornhub. There's something fucked up going on in that whole, and your mum was on Pornhub. Your mum, like, which I'd be personally just trying to distance myself a little bit just so the kids don't, just takes a while for them to find out. Nothing, you know, I'm not knocking it, but, you know, each their own. But and there's got to be something going on there in that whole loop.
And every time he's actually a pretty good example, because every time he starts to talk about things that are important to him, that he goes on like a big rant about something that he's starting to make some sense, then they boom, he's checked into the nut house. You know, they instantly.
Oh, I'm a bit of a Kanye fan, to be honest. I've followed him since day one, and like since when he first started, and from his roots. I feel like he had some really good points. And that actually makes me want to circle back to one thing quickly with you that you mentioned about Obama abolishing the, changing that propaganda law.
Yeah.
Is that the main reason why Trump says everything's fake news? Is that what's behind his comment? And if so, why doesn't Trump try and reverse it back to how it was and put the law back in place?
I think it's like when we talked about how they legalized propaganda, and then we of course laughed because it's like they were lying all along, you know, it had always been fake. Now they just made it legal. That wasn't when the lies started. That's just when the lies were legalized. I think that the lies, you know, it always kind of made me laugh the first time I heard it, that they were legalizing propaganda, because I was thinking, well, they've been doing it for a long time. Why are they? They break the laws on everywhere they can. Why are they all of a sudden so concerned with actually trying to justify it and cover their asses and make it legal? But it's not like fake news started, you know, when that law was passed. Most people don't even know that it exists. But I mean, I think that it served to more so to protect people that were willing but semi-innocent participants in it, like the crisis actor groups and things like that, because that all started after 2012. You started to see these groups of people that were being brought into these drills, large groups of people, and I think maybe that served to protect them, to give them a layer of safety, so that they couldn't be prosecuted if later it was found out that, you know, Sandy Hook was a drill that was passed off as a real event, and these people that were participating in it might say, "Oh shit, I don't want to be involved in that." Like, no, it's fine. You're covered legally. There's nothing that's going to happen to you. That's one that I've taken heat on, but I stand by my claim that Sandy Hook was a drill. In fact, I have the paperwork.
You and Alex Jones.
Well, Alex Jones backpedaled on it because he got a lot of heat for it. But I have the document that shows that it was a joint venture, what's known as an integrated capstone event. That's a joint venture between Department of Homeland Security and FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency. Someone gave me the document on it. No, it wasn't classified, but it was something that was from the event. And it shows
crazy. I mean,
it's crazy.
I can't comment on it because I understand all these false flags thing, mm-hmm. and I get the process of what you're saying, and I get I understand why they're doing it, but that seems so twisted and wicked.
I agree.
But then
it's tough to wrap your head around.
They let companies. It is, but then you think they let companies scare the shit out of you on a daily basis just on advertising.
Oh, all the time. it's the best marketing tool. So why wouldn't they?
You think dying every 20 seconds by watching the ads. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying it's the same thing, but...
I'm glad you got that when you came over. I'm glad that you noticed all the ads, because there's only two countries that allow pharmaceutical ads to be run on television, and that's us. That's New Zealand and the United States. And if you watch the night,
you don't notice it in New Zealand.
Oh, you don't notice it there? Well,
not the US. Like, I've always seen it, but I was with a group of mates who hadn't spent as much time in the US, and I was sitting down, we're like, fuck, like, oh, you got a sore knee, you're dead, you're gonna die. It's
crazy. If you watch the nightly news, the national nightly news, no exaggeration, 50% of the ads are from pharmaceutical companies. So people say, well, if vaccines are really hurting kids, if they're really bad for people, if the flu shots are filled with all these toxins, why don't I hear about it on the nightly news? Like, clearly this would be an important topic. Well, because the pharmaceutical heads of the companies would be down in the office of the president of ABC, NBC, and CBS the next morning. If somebody in their news organization decided to do some expose on the vaccine industry, they'd be down there saying, we're going to pull $1 billion worth of advertising from you. How dare you put a story like that? So it'll never happen. So I think a lot of people...
I need to do a vaccine episode, obviously, with you, because it's obviously something that's, you know, quite a lot about. I'm still on the sort of vaccine train out here, because that's what I've grown up on, and it's hard to turn. Like, there's only a small community, such a small community of people that are not vaccinating their children and things like that. And the hate towards the people that aren't vaccinating is very strong out here in Australia.
Yeah. You guys are, that's the one aspect that you guys take the lead from us even, but we're getting that way. We're going, you know, in California, they passed a law mandating it for every child that's entering school has to be fully vaccinated.
Same and, with here.
Yeah. But and the problem is, you know, right now the vaccination schedule is like 77 or 78 different vaccines you have to have during the course of a certain couple of years, but there's over 200 that are in the pipeline that are working their way through, and they're going to be made mandatory at some point once they work their way through the system. And what's funny, well, not funny, but sort of scary, that people in the United States don't realize, they don't realize a lot about the vaccine. And like you said, we can have a different show on that, but what they don't understand is that a group like the CDC, which is the Centers for Disease Control, which is the government organization that is mandating the vaccines and that is in charge of the safety of it, they own the patents on a lot of the vaccines. So they make billions and billions of dollars. So they have a conflict of interest with this. So they're pushing vaccines because they're making money off of them too, which is something that they don't mention anywhere. And I think that that's information that people would want to know. So yeah, we can go down that. That's a dark topic that,
it is such a dark topic.
Very polarizing, and people get very worked up, and I totally see it. I mean, I see both sides of it for sure. And it is, you know, it's one of those issues that it's like, in order for everybody to have a real good, honest conversation about it, everybody needs to have the information, and that information is suppressed right now. There's so much of it just because it's such a major industry.
Hard to find. You don't sit down with your children and they go, okay, this is exactly what's in here. We were talking about this on a podcast with someone in the US about like what's in the water at home and trying to like what's in our tap water. Like it is so hard to find out what is exactly in our tap water.
Yeah.
And it's the same with vaccines. Like it's probably about education and then making the decisions. I've got like one or two friends that don't vaccinate, and I know that there's definitely an opinion about why they don't, and like it's a negative connotation associated to it. But I'd love to sit down and we can have more of a chat about that when you've got more time. One last thing, in the pod the other week, you mentioned, I think I understood correctly, that you were co-writing a book. Was that right? Were you about to release a book at Anacapulco?
There's a Jeff Berwick, who is the promoter of Anarchapulco. He's the owner of the Dollar Vigilante, and he has a podcast called The Anarchast. He's a good dude. He wrote a book. I contributed with him, and we'll be releasing that during Anarchapulco. That'll be a good. And I think I'm going to see you there.
Try to get over there, definitely. It's just timing for next year. Things are already getting a little bit hectic, but
it ought to be a good place. There's a lot of interesting, there's gonna be a lot of interesting people there. Grab your camera and your microphone.
Let's do some
interviews.
I saw there's like 3-day DMT things, and like it's gonna be a trip, man. when you first told me about it, I was like, okay, I'll have a look into this. And I was like, I've never seen anything like this event as far as
I've never been either, so this will be my first time. I'm gonna be speaking at the Dollar Vigilante Summit and at Anarchapulco. David Icke will be there, Ron Paul, Luke Radowski, Derek Bros, some good reporters will be there, and Jeff Berwick, who's putting it on. He's an awesome dude. He's doing some really great stuff. So it'll be fun. He's a proponent of anarchy. And so people said, well, if you like anarchy so much, why don't you go to Somalia and tell us how you like it? So he's like, okay. So he grabbed Luke Radowski and the two of them went to Somalia for a couple days and filmed there. And they were like, it's out of control. And they showed like from where they were from inside their hotel courtyard, they could kind of look up in the sky and you see airplanes going by. And he's like, the only airplanes we see coming in and out of there are all, they, you know, the guys, the guards say, oh, those are all from the World Bank.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. So,
I'm not surprised.
That'll be a good event. So, yeah. So, I mean, we're living in a really screwy, you know, a screwy world. But, and just when I think we're starting to make progress, we see George H.W. Bush dies. They have these funerals, and then the media and the population just goes, "Oh, we miss him. He was so great." And you just want to go, "You don't even know. Like, how dare you? How dare CNN do these things?" And they don't even talk about who he was.
And that's where just promoting conversation to try and make change, like doing things like this and writing books. Like, so yeah, listeners, you've got to jump online, go to Amazon, get The Octopus of Global Control. What about a website? Your face? I don't do Facebook. I hate social media, so I don't.
You're smart.
I hate it. I can't.
No, you're smart to be off of it. It's a horrible, it's a disgusting place. But anyway, yes, I'm on Facebook, .com/ The Octopus of Global Control. You can get on there. You can send me messages, you can tell me I'm an asshole, whatever.
But you've got to get the book. Anyone that listens to the podcast, you have to get it. It's such a great read, so fun. And my guard dogs are going off, so that might mean that the CIA
they're here to put you in the nut house.
I've got some killer dogs here, so they'd need a few. But thanks again, mate. Really appreciate it. Love chatting. Let's do it again.
Yeah, me too.
Let's do it. And yeah, take care, mate.
You too. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
Yeah.